Into sports.
20 yards out, Urs to shoot, don't shoot! Oh, what a goal for Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah.
No. Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your App Store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network with Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
You're welcome along to this evening's football show. Now, later on, we'll be talking to Richard Dunn. Man City are cruising on all fronts. They were 3-1 winners this evening against Swansea. Also, you might have seen footage of Phil Foden as ball boy for Man City team captain by Richard Dunn back in the day. We're going to chart Foden's rise from ball boy to ball wonder. Ask Richard as well about some of the bigger names who've come through the City Academy in his time there. A lot of good products out of the Man City Academy, actually. So Richard Dunn on the way this hour. Should let you know, it's turning into a brilliant game at Goodison Park. Spurs took the lead, courtesy of Davinson Sanchez, after just 3 minutes. Dominic Calvert-Lewin equalised for Everton. 2 minutes after that, on 38 minutes, Richarlison put Everton 2-1 up. Then 6 minutes after that, Gylfi Sigurdsson put Everton 3-1 up. And now 2 minutes after that, on 45 minutes, I'm just after seeing Spurs have equalised. So that's about as mad a 10 minutes as it gets. Everton scored their first, then Everton scored their second, then Everton scored their third, then Spurs scored their second. So the short version is, it's 3-2 at half-time and we've had 4 goals in 10 minutes at Goodison. I'll let you know who got that Spurs second in just a moment. It's coming through, but it's 3-2 at half-time. It's just gone half-time. In the other games on at the moment, nil-all still between Leicester and Brighton. This hasn't been a very good game. 78 minutes on the clock, not much goal-mouth action. And in the other game, also 78 minutes on the clock, Sheffield United 1-0 up on Bristol City. Now, as I mentioned before the news headlines there, you'll have seen Mike Dean has taken charge of that rather dull game between Leicester and Brighton this evening. But after receiving death threats following the dismissal of Thomas Souček at the weekend, Dean, at his own request, won't be taking charge of a Premier League game this weekend coming. To discuss, we have Dermot Gallagher with us, 1,200 professional games as a referee, first division debut aged 33 in 1990, and finished up 17 years later in 2007, was a FIFA referee as well, took the 96 FA Cup final, United-Liverpool in Cantona at Wembley. Dermot, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining us. I know you moved a few things around to join us at this time, so it's appreciated. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, I introduced you as Dermot Gallagher, and this is from years of watching you on English television, but of course I'm talking to Rings End's Dermot Gallagher, so should I be saying Gallagher?
That doesn't matter. I'm so used to it now, Joe, honestly. I got called all the names. Nobody could pronounce my name right when I came to England, so it doesn't matter. I'm well worn into it.
I can imagine. Did you experience anything like this Mike Dean situation, a death threat, Dermot?
I didn't. I was talking earlier in the week when I did my slot on Sky. I said to Stephen Warnock and Sue Smith, I look back. I'm not a great one for looking back, I hasten to say. It's only on when people ask me questions, I talk about, I don't volunteer information about the past, but I look back at when I refereed, and I think I was very, very lucky in so much as there wasn't the social media. And I said to both Stephen and Susan that when I refereed, without doubt, the players gave you a bit of stick. You know, now and again, you'd have a manager come to the dressing room afterwards and he was unhappy about a decision. You might even have the misfortune to go out to the car park and a few supporters were waiting half hour, 45 minutes after the game to give you a little bit of stick. But when you drove out of the car park, the minute you hit the main road, it was over. You know, that was it. It brought closure. And, you know, I watch all the Premier League games now. I'm very, very privileged that I've got a studio to go into every Saturday, every Sunday, every match day. And I watch every single game live. And not one live game. Every single match is being beamed in. And I watched the game on Saturday and I didn't think it was a red card at the time. I, I don't think it's a red card now, and everybody's in agreement with me. But with what's rolled out since, Joe, I'm quite flabbergasted that, you know, a guy goes to work on a Saturday, and that's all he's doing. He's going to work, and he's working in an industry that, when I was a boy in Ringsend growing up, I just wanted to be a footballer. I used to tell my dad I'd play at Lansdowne Road one day, and he laughed at me. And, you know, God willing, I did set foot on the pitch one day and referee a game there. But it was a pleasure. You know, when I was a schoolboy, it was a pleasure. When I was a teenager, it was a pleasure. When I came to England, I played football until I was 21 when I was seriously ill and I took up refereeing. And it was a pleasure. And you mentioned about the 1,200 games I did, and it was a pleasure. Now, what's changed that people want to take that pleasure away? Because Mike Dean has gone to work on Saturday, a work that I will tell you is an absolute dream. If you can't play football at the highest level, to go and referee at the highest level is the second best thing. And you have a job that you couldn't have dreamt of when you were a schoolboy. And he made a mistake. That's all he did. All he was guilty of was making a mistake. And I would also hasten to add, Joe, that the mistake was driven by somebody else, because if you watched the images, you know, Mike Dean's looking at the incident. He seems to deal with it on the field. The two players seem happy to get on. And then suddenly it's triggered by the VAR. And I honestly, Joe, in my heart of hearts, I don't think he should have been sent to that monitor. And I think that's where the damage was done for Mike Dean on Saturday.
2007 was probably a nice time to retire. You were just ahead, out the door ahead of the advent of social media becoming as prevalent as it is now. The issue with social media is it gives everybody a voice. And it's easy for me to sit here and for everybody else to assume that the death threat that went Mike Dean's way, and the way of his family, we should add as well, it's easy to assume that is just an idiot or a kid who's no more capable of carrying out anything remotely close to what was threatened. However, if I was Mike Dean, or if I was in his family, it would cause havoc in my life. And that's the really tricky thing when it comes to social media. I mean, okay, look, police get involved and they'll track this idiot down. But I mean, another idiot next week can set up a third social media account and fire in the same death threat that he or she has no intention of carrying out. But it's the havoc that it causes for a referee.
Well, it's not just a referee. And, you know, let's not forget, you know, we've seen footballers subject to this in the last few weeks. A number of footballers have been harassed on social media platforms. But talking about Mike, because that's what you asked me to do, you know, I would say, you know, I just can't believe what he would have been going through on Saturday evening, Sunday morning. I can't even describe in words what he must have felt. The one thing I will say is that the PGMO, you know, who govern the referees at the top level, cascading right the way down through the leagues, they have an infrastructure now of support which is second to none. You know, and what will happen is Mike will be ring fenced. You know, he'll be monitored daily. He'll be able to speak to people. And the other thing I'd say is the pool of referees around him will support him as if it happened to them. You know, they will ring fence Mike, and they will ensure that he's in the right possible frame of mind. And he's obviously a very, very strong person mentally, because he's gone out to referee in the FA Cup at Leicester tonight. And I think he was due to do that. So he's fulfilled that. And then what he's going to do, he's going to have, it will be 10, 11 days break to just probably gather his thoughts, just let the dust settle and speak to his family, you know, and enjoy them, you know, enjoy the pleasure that they bring him and surround himself with happy things, happy thoughts, to put him back in the great place that he wants to be back out on the football field.
Do you know him well?
I work with Mike because you have to remember that Mike came onto the Premier League in the mid to late 90s. I didn't leave until 2007. You know, I was very, very lucky and very privileged. I worked with Mike. He was a brilliant trainer. There's no doubt about that. I prided myself when I was very, very fit and was always out there doing my stuff. Mike would compete with me. What I will say, he's a brilliant person. He's got a wonderful sense of humour, which people don't appreciate. They don't realise he's got that. He's a very, very great sportsman. I mean, he plays golf off about 4 or 5. He's, when we had sporting challenges, you always wanted to be in his team because he was a great competitor. But he's a genuine guy, and he doesn't deserve this no more than anybody does, Joe.
No, it's insane when you stop and think about it, that we're talking about death threats in football. It's really shocking. Like, I'm watching him here on my screen, he's jogging around the pitch, and it's just mad to think what's potentially going through his head. I'm sure it's maybe a bit of a relief for him to get out on a pitch for 90 minutes and forget about it. So there's no doubt, Dermot, that social media has just inflamed everything. What about at matches? I don't know how often you get to a game in person, certainly pre-COVID anyway. You've been there in the heat of it from, say, 1990 first division debut through until 07. So say, take 20 years ago, around 2000, 2001. How does the abuse coming from the stand, do you think, compare, say, last year before COVID to 2001?
It's quite strange because one of the things, especially when I used to, you know, before COVID, I used to go home back to Dublin at least once a month, you know, even if it was only for 2 or 3 days, I'd always take that opportunity because, you know, I've got friends, family there, referees who I've worked with. And it just allowed me to get back out of England and about out of that. But it's weird that they always ask me that same question. And I can honestly tell you that in the big games, I never heard anything because it was just a cacophony of sound.
Yeah.
It just got lost. What was the frightening thing? And when I live in a village now, a village in Oxfordshire, and it's a small village. They've got a village football team. And I go up, you know, if say there's a blank weekend and Ireland are playing away and I can't go to the game, you know, say they were in Georgia one time. So I go up to the village to watch. And that's where I see the problem because there's 7, 8 people watching. And if one of them lets rip at you a few times during a match, you hear every word, it becomes personal. So I think it's the hardest part, really, when you're refereeing regarding on-field abuse is when you're starting out, you know, you're trying to find your way and there's very, very small crowds and they can get stuck into you. When there's bigger crowds, I mean, imagine being at Lansdowne Road, you know, for an international. No matter what the supporters shouted at the referee, there's very, very little chance he'd ever hear it.
So hard to detect, really, if there's a big difference in a Premier League crowd 10, 20 years ago with now.
Well, I wouldn't think there is, to be honest. But in many ways, I'd feel that the chanting from the stands now would be less so because it's all seater. So it is less tribal. And you see more families at football now. You see much more women at football, which is brilliant. Much more children at football. You know, you actually, when we're getting ready for games 3 o'clock on a Saturday, as we used to, and it's 4 or 5 games and you're scanning around the grounds half hour before, you see the families sat eating their food before games and you think, well, this wasn't quite like this when I was a little boy going down to Milltown. You had to be there early because you had to stand on the terraces. You had to get a spot, otherwise somebody would nick it off you. But now your seat's there. It's a different environment.
Yeah, it's a pity that doesn't extend to social media. When did you move to England, by the way, Dermot?
I went twice, actually. I went when I was 8 and a half, November 65, when I had my first house. My dad got a job on the railway in England. He wanted to move into a house. And then we lost our mammy when I was 13, and I went back to Dean's Grange to my granny's. And then I really moved to England full-time in July 73 when I was 16, because I had to start work. So I got work in England.
Wow. Different times. What did you start work at 16?
A newspaper printer. It's quite ironic. I was on the keyboards. I used to do all the typing for the newspapers, and I was quite good at it, actually, because I got such tiny hands, so I was quite quick. But I'm glad that didn't last very long.
I didn't realise, maybe everybody did all those years watching you, I guess I was that bit younger in your Premier League days, I didn't realise the Irish accent had survived this much.
Well, it's because I'm talking to Irish people. My best mate, Alan Wiley, gives me no end of stick, because I have to crank it down a bit with English people. And it was quite ironic when my dad was alive, God bless him, one of my friends said to me, why do you talk Irish to your dad and you talk English to us? And I went, I don't. I always think they meant Gaelic, you see. And they went, no, your accent changes. I said, well, you wouldn't understand me. And they don't. When I first started on Sky TV, they were very, very conscious of certain words I couldn't pronounce. And I had to, like, watch the BBC News to try and, words with TH in it, I found very, very difficult. So I'd have to practice. I'd be dreading them, say, was it a Thursday match and whatever. And they were trying to explain to me there was a H in the word Thursday and it wasn't T-U-R-S.
It was nice to hear you talk about refereeing there in a positive way, because we only ever talk about refereeing as a tough job, a lot of abuse, thankless task, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, you talk to somebody like you. So 1990 through to 2007, you were on the pitch witnessing mm-hmm. some of the best players in the world, and you had the greatest seat in the house for free mm-hmm. kicks, for some amazing first touches, for some amazing mm-hmm. passes. And yeah. Maybe we underappreciate that. I mean, who were your favourite players? Who took your breath away on a pitch?
Loads of players. But I tell a story about Zinedine Zidane, and I don't say that to name drop. It was just amazing.
Name drop away here.
No. I was the Champions League semi-final. You picture yourself, it's a Champions League semi-final, and Del Piero got the ball on the left wing. We're playing at the Del Alpi. I'd got the first leg of the game, which is obviously, you want the first leg because you don't want the second leg in case it's all over by then. But Del Piero got the ball, and he smashed it across the pitch towards Zinedine Zidane. And as it went by me, it was about shoulder height, and it sounded like a tennis ball coming off the tee. It was going so fast. And Zinedine Zidane put his foot out, and I thought, good luck with that. And he just cushioned it, brought it down, and knocked it off to Antonio Conte on the other wing. And I've just gone, wow. I mean, this is in one of the biggest matches in the world. And he brought it down as if it was, you know, on the school playground.
Yeah. You probably got even a deeper appreciation of how good these guys are.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the reason you realise how good they are is because one thing I had to do is train and train and train to get up to the speed they move. And when I played football, you know, I thought it was difficult to control a ball at certain times. You know, the ball would come to me fast and I'd have to lay it off fast. When I went into professional football, I mean, it was incredible. When I went back, what I used to do on a Saturday, if I refereed in the Premier League, I always used to referee in the Sunday League the next day in one of the villages near me. And the reason I did that was twofold. Firstly, it kept me very, very grounded. It didn't allow me to become a big-time Charlie. It meant that I was very, very humble, like my dad brought me up to be. And the second thing was, it allowed me to almost do a recovery session, because I'd go out on a Sunday morning and I'd be jogging about, and the game was like slow motion compared to the day before. Mm. And that's the biggest thing, is people don't realise the speed that these players are moving at, the speed the ball's moving at, and the speed of thought that they have to move the ball on.
Yeah, joy to be around. I guess I would presume the better players, it's easier to predict the flow of a Premier League game than a Sunday League game.
I think, Joe, what I learned in refereeing was the higher you go, the easier it is to referee, because you can judge the pattern. The players are more disciplined because they can't afford to lose players, they can't afford suspensions, they can't afford to go down to 10 men. But what I would say, the higher you go, if a match is tough, it is really tough, much tougher than any other. You know, if a match really turns out tough, you have a really tough night.
As in tough, as in physical?
All kinds of things. You know, if a match turns sour, I refereed in the African Nations Cup, I refereed in Alexandria in Egypt. And Syria were playing the Ivory Coast. Syria needed to win. The Ivory Coast needed to draw to go through. We played 64 minutes. Syria winning 2-1. It wasn't really a problem because the Ivory Coast only needed a goal. And I give a penalty for a boy handling the ball on the line. So I had to send him off. And between minute 64 and minute 81, which is only 17 minutes, there was 3 red cards for the Ivory Coast and there were 6 yellow cards. Now, that... anybody who checks my stats go, that's not me refereeing that game. Mm. But what they did, when they went 3-1 down, they completely lost their heads because they realised they were at the competition. And it became one of the most difficult 17 minutes I'd ever had in my life.
Mm. What was Roy like to referee?
It was great, actually, because he used to talk to me. And knowing I was a Dublin boy, he'd give me a chance. But, you know, if he thought you made a mistake, he'd let you know it. But I would say I always got on well with him, and evidence of that, you know, he would say, you know, I booked him a few times, but he certainly deserved it. But I didn't ever have to even get close to telling him he was on a red card or even produce a red card. Mm. But I thought he was another player who was just driven by competitive edge, you know, fantastic. and a great guy to be around. You know, you see him on the field, he just picks people up, doesn't he, and leads them. Mm.
Could you sense his leadership if you were doing a United game and they were, you know, backs against the wall? I guess you're hearing what he's saying. You're hearing a lot of the conversations.
Yeah, yeah. You know, he was a great leader. I mean, evidence of that. I mean, you've only got to look back to Lansdowne Road when Ireland played Holland. You know, everybody talks about the McAteer goal, but they forget that Gary Kelly was sent off after 30 minutes and Roy Keane drove us through that match. You know, that next hour was one of the best performances you ever see from a footballer in view of how he played and how his leadership and whatever. Mm. And, you know, as well as McAteer saying, well, I scored the goal that got us to Japan. You know, Roy Keane just took that game on himself.
What was the tradition at Dermot when you'd go into your referee's room? Like, could a knock on the door happen and Alex Ferguson would be there? Would things like that happen?
It's changed now, obviously, and it's changed a bit more because of the COVID. But when I was refereeing, we'll say a 3 o'clock game because it's easy to describe. You know, I'd turn up. I like to get to a ground as late as possible because I wasn't one for getting there at 1 o'clock because there's too much sitting about and too much just stewing time. So I'd like to get there in an ideal world at 1:45 when the security briefing was on. But the drivers who took you wouldn't have that. You know, they'd always want to get you there by the latest 1:30. I'd go in, lay my kit out, security come in, do that. 2 o'clock, the managers had come in with the team sheets and the captains. Alex Ferguson wasn't one to come in for Manchester United. You know, it was always Brian Kidd, Tony Colton, I remember coming in. Others had come in. You didn't see him. So if a manager decided to send a representative, that was it. So, and what actually happened? I mean, people couldn't believe this, you know, to say, what were the players like off the field? Well, if I arrived at any ground at 1:30, you know, I'm preparing until 2 o'clock. Then much after 2 o'clock, I'm changing, stretching, going out on the pitch at 2:30, getting warmed up. I come in after the game, shower, fill in the sheets on if there's any yellow cards, red cards, and then I'm gone. Mm. You know, you don't really see anybody. You go, you arrive as a stranger and you leave as a stranger.
So it was pretty rare when you were having your post-match shower for someone to come barging in saying, "Oi, Gallagher."
I had one or two, there's no doubt about that. Yeah, it was because there's the 30 minute curfew, they can't come in for okay. 30 minutes. But, okay. You know, one or two of them said to me, "Well, set your watch, I'll be in." And I think the 30 minute curfew was brilliant because I think, you know, if any manager comes barging in straight at, say, 1:45, there's a fair chance, Joe, he's not going to come in to tell me how well I've done.
No.
There's a fair chance he's going to come in to, you know, take out his anger on me. Well, I think that 1/2 hour, it's amazing what that does, because that 1/2 hour, you know, it might not completely diffuse him, but it's going to take a lot of the real nasty anger out of him. Mm. So when he comes in, he's willing to have a conversation and he's willing to listen to your side. He might not agree with you, but he's willing to listen to your side rather than, you know, just bang, 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 you know, and just give you both barrels.
Did you like to talk to players a lot during the game, even in open play?
Only when I had to. You know, I was quite willing to interact, but I didn't want to be, I just didn't want to run in commentary of games. So player by me, you know, I'd speak to them. And I'd always try and speak to them by name as well, Joe. It's how I was brought up in Ireland. The biggest thing for me as a boy was everybody called my dad Paddy, you know, and every parent of my friends, we called them by their name, excuse me. So it was a big thing, you know, names are precious. So if I could talk to a player, I'd always try and call him by name and, you know, just say, "Look, Joe, you know, be mindful, you know, that I gave a foul, but the next time it might not be just a foul." And, you know, just little things, little, just knocking about and, you know, I might say a few things, but I wouldn't interact for the sake of just trying to talk to a player because, A, I've got to concentrate on my own game, and B, he doesn't really want it anyhow, does he?
No. I guess, though, that's much better than going with the schoolmaster approach to talk to players on a level as opposed to, you know, get away from me and, you know, I'm the main man here.
That wouldn't have suited me.
No.
It wouldn't. See, the thing is, I learned in life, and I was very, very lucky, as I say, because my granny was a massive influence on me in my life. And she just taught me to be a good person. And the thing is, as a referee, you've got to be yourself. You can't be an actor. Mm. So it's no good trying to be Dermot Gallagher walking up and down the streets of Oddicott and some dictatorial headmaster, if you like, on a football field, because it wouldn't suit me. And therefore, I wouldn't be able to concentrate and do my own role properly. So it's easier to be yourself.
Dermot, who's the best referee in the Premier League today?
I would think there's two. Michael Oliver and Anthony Taylor, I think, are outstanding. And I really do. I think both of them will be vying to go to the Euros. I would like to think that the UEFA will take both of them. If they only take one, I think they've got a very difficult decision to split them, because we're about 22, 23 rounds into the Premier League. I've watched them week in, week out. They both perform very, very high level. They both make very, very few mistakes. They both eliminate big mistakes, which is the key thing. But more importantly, they both go out week in, week out consistently. Hmm.
What was the toughest afternoon in your career then? What was the one you got wrong that still irks you, or that was hard to take at the time? I know there have probably been hundreds. Sorry, actually, I'm sure there haven't. half a dozen tops.
Joe, there's someone at the door. I've got to go. Built me up and slaughtered me. It's easy. And I learned so much from it. I think it was about 2001, I refereed West Brom and Aston Villa. And Mark Delaney, was just before halftime. And Mark Delaney, he's heading into the area. And it looks to me as though he's leaning forward. And straight away I thought, he's going to hit the ground here. And I learned so much from this decision, honestly. And he did hit the ground, just as I thought. The only thing is, I didn't allow for Phil Gilchrist taking him off at the knee. And I gave it the biggest cut the grass ever, went goal kick and walked back. And Dion Dublin was stood next to me. I bump into Dion regular down at the studio now. And he often pulls my leg about this. And he just goes, "You didn't fancy that, pal?" I said, "Do you think it was a penalty?" He said, "I did." He said, "But you don't." He said, "So there's no point in arguing." I'm like, "Oh, wow." Gareth Barry didn't quite see it like that, because he gave me dog's abuse. So we're coming off at halftime and Gareth Barry's giving me rah, 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 rah. And Dion was going, "Oh, leave him alone. He didn't do it deliberate." So I've got in the dressing room at halftime and I said to the linesman, "Did you think that was a penalty?" He said, "It's the most blatant penalty I've ever seen in my life." And I'm like, "Well, why didn't you help me out then?"
Yeah.
And he said, "Damn it," he said, "when you give it the biggest cut the grass I've ever seen in my life," he said, "what can I possibly do to change your mind?" Mm. And the things I learned there was, A, don't make a decision before it's happened, which I did, and B, don't close your options, which I did. But the upshot of the story was, and Dion will tell you this is not a joke, in the second half, every time something went to West Brom against Villa, Gareth Barry went to me, that's your fault. About 7 minutes to go, I gave Villa a penalty. And Dion said it was brilliant. He took it and he missed. And he was expecting a load of stick. And I turned to Gareth Barry and said, "I suppose that's my fault as well, is it?" He went mad.
What was your, modus operandi when a Gareth Barry was unleashing on you? Because it just goes with the job that players are emotional and they are going to come up and they're going to use bad language towards you. And they're going to say, you know, how terrible you are and your disgrace and hell, maybe even you're a cheat as well. Who knows? What was your attitude towards what's the line here before I have to book you?
Right. No one ever called me a cheat. No, I can honestly say in 1,200 plus pro matches, no one ever called me a cheat. Mm. And I know that for a fact because I've never sent somebody off for calling me a cheat. And I can tell you, Joe, I would, if anybody called me a cheat, I'd send them off, because to me, you can call me incompetent. You know, you can criticise decisions. That's your prerogative and that's an opinion. But to call a referee a cheat is just totally devaluing his integrity and his credibility. Mm. And that for me is a step too far. I think when people talk to you on the field, it's a matter of, is it spiteful? Is it nasty? Is it malicious? And if anybody said something what I term as spiteful, nasty, or malicious towards myself or my two assistants or another player, that's when I would red card. And I can honestly say I sent one player off for being very, very nasty and spiteful to a linesman, as he was then. One player sent off for being very nasty and spiteful to an opponent. And I never had to send a player off for being nasty and spiteful to me.
Right. To an opponent, really, did you?
It was in a semi-pro game a long time ago.
Okay.
And he really did say something very nasty and spiteful.
Do Premier League players get nasty and spiteful with each other?
They get spiky, they get feisty. Mm. But I think there's a big difference, isn't there? Because I think referees are well aware that in cricket they call it sledging, don't they?
Yeah.
That players will have a little pop. And I think both players, you know, the player is given it, the player has received it, we'll see that as part of the game. And often they'll give it back later on. But when something becomes personal, spiteful or malicious, as I say, that's when you've got to say, well, you can't do that. You know, you've got to suffer the sanction.
Well, listen, it was great talking to you. I've completely run out of time. It was more of a tangent we've gone on there. It was meant to be largely about Mike Dean. You won't be surprised to hear I have about 20 text messages in saying, can you ask him for his thoughts on VAR? Let's do that. Let's chat another time, maybe in a month or two, Dermot, and get your thoughts on where refereeing is.
Maybe.
Great. But for the time being, Dermot Gallagher for the Irish Knight that's in it. Thanks so much. Good to talk to you.
Josh, been a pleasure.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See Dunleary.net.
Now you're welcome back. You're listening to the football show. We'll get Dermot Gallagher on again sometime, by the way. There's loads more to talk to him about. Football on Off the Ball is with thanks to Paddy Power. For information on responsible gambling, visit gamblingcare.ie. Let's check in on how the action is going. Shane Pinnington at Goodison Park.
It's Everton 3, Tottenham 3, and this is a cracking cup tie here at Goodison Park, which continues to swing one way and the other. And since Tottenham equalised through Davinson Sanchez's second of the evening, they've looked more on the front foot once again like they had for most of the first half. Although Gylfi Sigurdsson's just missed a good chance for Everton, a cross in from this left-hand side, and Sigurdsson met it on the volley 20 yards out and it just went over the top. It's Everton 3, Tottenham 3.
Now, very happy to say we have Richard Dunn with us. Richard, evening.
Good evening.
We just had Dermot Gallagher on talking refereeing. What was he like as a ref?
He was great. He was a fan of all the Irish players, so we normally got the decisions off him.
Dermot, I'm a dub, come on.
Yeah, you don't normally let us away with a few bad tackles, and I think Gary Kelly at Leeds had him in his pocket at times. Could do what he liked.
I heard that. They were good friends. I think he refed at Gary's testimonial and everything.
Yeah, he's a good man, Dermot. Nice guy.
Yeah, seems to be. So we were talking about the Mike Dean situation, which is just nuts, like death threats happening and all that stuff. It's crazy.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Man City, league title over. What's happened here? Because it looks so indifferent up until really the Stamford Bridge game, and then, vroom, it's just gone into overdrive, crazy. So what's been the difference for you? I'm sure you watched them closely.
Yeah, when I watch them and think back to the start of the season, you can't really put your finger on what was wrong with them at the start of the season. You're looking at them and you're thinking they're playing well, they're moving the ball quickly, they're just not the same tempo as what they had been previously. And then sort of as the season's progressed, and you're seeing like against Leeds where they were great for 20 minutes and then they took their foot off the gas, and then the following week they'd be great for 30 minutes and then take their foot off the gas. And I think because they missed the pre-season, they just seem now like they've eased their way into the season. They've kept in a reasonable position at the time, and now they've just let the handbrake off and they've just gone for a full tilt, and the quality that they're producing is unbelievable. I've been lucky enough, I've been able to go to a couple of the matches and just to see the movement and the interaction between all the players and the different switching of positions and stuff like that. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, Kinsale popping up as a midfielder, all sorts going on.
Yeah, there's no set positions, it seems. They're just very fluid in what they do, and the individual quality of each player is incredible. I mean, you can get a good team, but when you've got almost the best players in the world in each position, it certainly helps. But the fact that they listen and they follow exactly what the manager seems to say to them, and just getting result after result. And at the moment, when you look around the league, there's nobody that can match the consistency, and they just look like they're on a stroll towards the league title at the moment.
I heard John Stones talking the other day, and he was saying at times when we're playing brilliant football out from the back, zipping it here, there, between the lines and everywhere, it looks amazing. He said, actually, it's really easy because Pep has things so well drilled. We kind of know the patterns. We know where everyone's going to be. So all the little flicks and touches almost just feel preordained. And it's really just, it's enjoyable. It's definitely, you know, it doesn't feel like we're doing anything extraordinary. It feels easy to be in that unit and doing it.
Yeah.
And I just thought, my God, Guardiola's a genius. What would you give? What would you give to, like, hang out and watch how Guardiola does it? Have you had access to watching him training?
No, I haven't seen any of the training sessions. Okay. But you just watch the games, you just think there's no difficult passes in it. Everything is a simple pass, and there's so much movement off the ball, and the passes are generally 5-10 yards, but then it moves across the pitch so quickly, it moves forward, and as soon as they get a block somewhere, they come back and they start again and go to the other side, and there's just no sort of panic in them. They just know eventually they'll break through and eventually they'll create an opportunity, and they're quite happy to sit back and pass and move, and every single one of them so comfortable in the ball, on the ball. It's brilliant. It's amazing to watch, and how he does it on the training field must be brilliant.
I know. He needs to like make a DVD. Yeah. You know, he can't just not share this down the line. So interesting. I hadn't realised you're at games. Ruben Dias and John Stones, what are you seeing with those two?
Basically lots of communication between the two of them. You're fortunate enough when there's nobody in the stadium, you can hear the players and who the leaders are. And Dias, although he's younger than John Stones, he's only at the club a short time, he seems like an organiser, someone that can put the rest of them in their place almost, and he senses danger, whereas previously I think you've had a lot of Man City centre-backs who are great on the ball and always looking to play forward and do the creative thing, probably not keeping their eye on the defensive side of it. But he seems to have stabilised them all. He's certainly improved John Stones' performances as well. And he's the one that I think is undroppable now. He's the one that organises everything and sort of gives everyone else that freedom, knowing that if there is an issue, he'll tell them and they'll recognise it quickly.
Who are the other big talkers for City?
De Bruyne is talking a lot. Sterling, they're all sort of, I think the further up the field you go, they start to get a little bit quieter, but I don't know whether they're communicating with their eyes or what they're doing, but they're not missing many passes. And like you were saying about John Stones and training, they seem to know where someone will be or should be. And there's all sorts of communication. To be able to swap positions and change and play either left back or centre midfield or right wing or whatever it is, it takes communication throughout the team, and you can see that it's running really smoothly. So whether you can hear them shouting or not as much, they're communicating in some way, or they're just running off mind almost what the repetition that they've done in training.
Which brings us to the boy wonder, Phil Foden. I don't know, did you see the footage today going around of him as ball boy in a Richard Dunn captained Manchester City?
I didn't see it today, no. Yeah. I've seen him a few times, different pictures of him as ball boy.
So he's semi-regular kind of ball boy. Is that like something you don't take any notice of when you're the captain of Manchester City? Or would you have kind of known, oh yeah, there's Phil again. Hey, Phil.
No, not at that. You sort of interact with the mascots as and ball boys and stuff like that as children, and how you enjoying your day and sort of stuff like that, rather than, oh, you heard you're an amazing footballer. Yeah. Or all that sort of
you're
stuff.
You're a threat. What position do you play?
No, so it's unusual when you see it. I've seen it with a few, like I think Trent Alexander-Arnold was one as well, who was a younger ball boy and managed to make it through. But it's brilliant when they do, because to see them, they've been at games, they've actually sat there and watched from pitch level, and to then for them to get up the opportunity to be the star on the pitch is brilliant.
Mm. I mean, it's amazing when you realise now at 20, he's made just over 100 appearances for City. He has scored 25 goals this season, 9 goals, 5 assists. He's played 1,000 minutes this season. Like, to think last year people were saying, does Foden need to move on? You know, is he getting, he's not a regular starter. And like, you forget he's 20. So we're talking here about an unbelievable talent, clearly. I know you're gone a while now from City, so to be fair, he was still very young, but was he on your radar by the time you left, or is it only really latterly that he's, you know, he's
I didn't know much about him, but I knew some coaches and physios and stuff like that who spoke highly of him and said he was a young kid who had a good chance. But the what they always said about him was his dribbling ability and how good he is at moving past players. And then when he's got into the first team, he seems like he's someone who gets the ball and passes it and moves an awful lot. So I've been watching.
Describe him as a dribbler?
Not really, no. And then when they, the last match was that, I think it was the Sheffield United game, and there was two or three times in it when he just picked it up in the central midfield role and he just glided past two or three players and you're like, wow. And it was, I got into a situation where I was going, I need to just watch him for a little bit, and then you're chatting with the cameraman and said, you need to do like a montage of just his first touch, because every time it comes to him, he creates space for himself. He either takes it away from a defender, he takes it past the defender, or he keeps it close to his body. He's just incredible to watch. And what I've seen over the course of the season, because he's playing more regular and he's getting more confident and being trusted a lot more, he's starting to take a bit more responsibility. And I think over the coming months that you'll start to see that bit more dribbling, because he has the ability to take people on. He can shift really quickly. And like you've seen with the goal at the weekend when he shifted it and just smashed it as hard as he could. And he's certainly got it, and I still think there's a lot more to come from him.
The Manchester City Academy seems to be pretty impressive. Take your 2000 to 2009 spell at the club. So here were some City Academy graduates during that time. You had, the main man, the man taking over the punditry world right now, Micah Richards, of course. Micah Richards big in our lives right now. You had Sean Wright Phillips, you had Casper Schmeichel, you had Sturridge, you had Joey Barton, you had Stephen Ireland, was an unbelievable talent when he came through. You had Ben Mee, Glenn Whelan, who's had an unbelievable career, Stephen Elliott, Greg Cunningham, probably others I haven't kind of managed to cobble together in the list, but actually that's a fairly healthy return, isn't it?
Yeah, there was so many. I remember when I was there, and it was like to add to that list, there was Nadim Anua, Michael Johnson, Chet Evans, all players
who played in the first team. Yeah,
he was amazing, and they were all players who came in and played in the first team and made a real impact. And so they've had it for a while, and probably then it was. I'm not saying it was easier to get into first team, but it was a different club, so we didn't have the world superstars that they have now. So it's probably a little bit more difficult for the academy players to get through, because it's not about being good enough for the Premier League. They have to be good enough for the Champions League, and they're still managing to get people through. I think in most of the games, and it's great because there's 9 subs, but he's managed to get 2 or 3 at least on the bench. And I think Tommy Doyle, he came on tonight, and the lad Gomez came on tonight. So he's trusting them and giving them little opportunities. And there's an awful lot of people just want, oh, he's a young lad, give him a chance. But you see him a fold, and it takes a little bit of time to earn the manager's trust and to understand the system and to be sort of comfortable to play in probably one of the best teams in the world. So it's not a straightforward, oh, you've played well under 23s, you go into it, but they're still managing to get players in. And I think it's brilliant that the setup at the club for the training ground for the young academy players coming through is just, it blow your mind when you see it. It's so good, and the pitches are perfect, and they've got everything that they need to be footballers there. It's just down to the players' dedication and hard work to make it.
I mentioned Micah Richards. He was in good form at the weekend. Just a little reminder for people.
frustrated would you be if you were in Chris Wilder's shoes and that had been awarded against you?
We'd want to be a manager. You know, it's hard to win football matches.
You told me you're taking me as an assistant. What are you talking about?
Listen. Just get my head around you as a management duo with Roy.
The kit man.
So I'd say Mick Richards, pretty grumpy fella around the camp day to day, yeah?
he's brilliant, Mick. When he came in, I think he was 17 or something like that.
Yeah.
He just lit the place up just with a smile. And regardless of if he made a mistake or whatever he did, he just laughed like that as loud as you possibly could. And it's just infectious. You can't help but join in. But yeah, he's a great fella, Mick.
He really does seem like a great fella. And actually, you know, it's got a set of stones on him as well, the way he mixes it with Roy. You know what I mean? Not everybody can mix it with Roy on TV. He's not phased.
No, not at all. And he's a strong character in his own right. And he's not bothered what people say to him. So if Roy has an answer back for him, he can handle it. And he's not out to hurt anyone or to upset people. He wants to have fun and he wants to enjoy it. And I think even Roy can see that he's a good lad and he means no harm. He's just infectious. He just makes you want to be in his company and laugh with him.
He was a brilliant prospect. I mean, I remember, like, you know, whatever football magazines were on the go back in the day, but even before he was in the first City team, he was being talked about as a huge prospect. By his own admission, maybe it didn't kind of fully blossom the way he'd hoped, Mick Richards.
Yeah, I mean, I think at City he'd done great. I remember when I was there, when they had, he'd only played half a season or whatever, and there was £20 million offers coming in from Tottenham and different places where normally Man City would almost need to sell because we didn't have that sort of money. But luckily they kept hold of him, and yeah, I think his career at City was great, and he moved on to Aston Villa, and then the injury started really sort of held him back. But it's unfortunate when it does happen like that, because he seemed to be going around for ages and then he still retired very young. So in one way, he's fortunate he managed to get a lot of football into a short career, but probably didn't fulfil what he set out to do.
Yeah, he's a bit unlucky, to be fair. I mean, he's still only 32. You know, he's still so young. But he's enjoying life, it seems, anyway. Listen, we'll see how City go over the next few weeks. Always good to talk to you. Thanks a million, Richard Dunn. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. Fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See Dunlewy.net.
The OTB Podcast Network. With Green Farm on the go. Snack smart with 100% natural protein-powered chicken bites.